The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, and welcome to That's a Laugh. I'm Sharon Silcox with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. May is the month for mothers. Let's celebrate mothers and laughter today and start with essays by Irma Bombeck found in her book, Forever Irma. We'll begin with a story titled Paint Tint Caper, written September 4th, 1965. Once, just once, I'd like to be dressed for an emergency. I don't mean like my grandmother used to warn. That is not underwear to be hit by a car in. I mean just to be glued together so you're not standing in a hospital hallway in a sweatshirt, property of Notre Dame Athletic Department, and a pair of bedroom slippers. In a way, it's almost as if fate were waging a cruel war, and you're in the middle of it. Not only are you A, bleeding to death, B, grimacing in pain, and C, worried half out of your skull, you are also plagued with the fear that the nurses in East Wing C are passing the hat to adopt you and your family for Thanksgiving. Take our paint tent caper, for example. Our small son climbed into bed with us early one morning and smiled broadly. I'm intuitive. I'm a mother. I sensed something was wrong. His teeth were blue. He had bitten into a tube of paint tint. Now, if you're visualizing some sweet tousle-haired boy in his fire engine pajamas, forget it. This kid looked like he was being raised by werewolves. In addition to his blue teeth, he was wearing a pair of training pants and his father's old T-shirt, which caught him loosely around the ankles. This was obviously no time to be proud or to explain that I was a few years behind in the laundry. We rode like the wind to the emergency ward of the hospital, where the doctor checked over his blue teeth so calmly I thought there was something wrong with mine because they were white. "What kind of paint tint?" he asked clinically. "Sky blue," we said shakily, pointing to the color on his T-shirt. "I can see that," he said irritably. "I mean, what did it contain chemically?" My husband and I stared at each other. "Normally, you understand, we don't let a can of paint into the house until we've committed the chemical contents and their percentages to memory. This one had escaped us somehow." While they were pumping his stomach, we took a good look at ourselves. My husband was in a pair of thrown-over-the-chair denims and his pajama top. I was wearing yesterday's house dress with no belt, no hose, and a scarf around my uncombed hair. I was clutching a dish towel, my only accessory. There are other stories, other dilemmas, but the characters never change. We're always standing around, unwashed, uncurled, harried, penniless, memory gone, no lipstick, no hose, unmatched shoes, and using the dirtiest cloth in the house to bind our wounds. Makes you want to plan your next accident, doesn't it? Next story, Waking Up Mama, written July 4th, 1966. How I am awakened in the morning usually determines how I feel the rest of the day. When allowed to wake up in the natural way, I find myself quite civil and reasonable to cope with the routine. When the children do the job for me, I awake surly, uncommunicative, and tire easily. I once fell asleep while I was having my tooth filled. It all begins at some small hour in the morning. The children line up at my bedside and stare at me as if I'm a white whale that has been washed onto the beach. I think she hears us. Her eyelids fluttered. Wait till she turns over. Then everybody cough. Get him out of here. She's pulling the covers over her ears. Start coughing. I don't know how long it will be before one of them discovers that by taking my pulse, they will be able to figure out by its rapid beat if I am faking or not. But it will come. When they were smaller, they were even less subtle. They would stick their wet fingers in the openings of my face and whisper, "You awake yet?" Or good old Daddy would simply heave a flannel-wrapped bundle at me and say, "Here's Mommy's little boy." Any mother with half a skull knows that when Daddy's little boy becomes Mommy's little boy, Daddy's little boy is so wet he's treading water. The imagination of children never fails to stagger me. Once they put a hamster on my chest, and when I bolted upright, my throat muscles paralyzed with fright, they asked, "Do you have any alcohol for the chemistry set?" Probably the most unnerving eye-opener was a couple of weeks ago when my eyes popped open without the slightest provocation. "Those rotten kids have done it again," I grumbled. "How can I sleep with that infernal quiet?" The last time it was this quiet, they were eating cereal on the front lawn in raggy pajamas. I hurried off to find them. I found them in the kitchen, intent on their cereal. No noise, no nonsense. "Go back to bed," they yelled. "We won't want any lunch until 9:30 or so." It was going to be another one of those days. Now let's hear How to Survive Motherhood, written September 1966. I have discovered that one of the rich rewards of motherhood is casting maledictions on your children in the event they become parents. It's a unique way of saying, "Just wait, kid. You're going to get yours." One of my earliest recollections of this tribal custom dates back to my childhood when one day I was nailed in the act of throwing mud balls and mother's corset flapping on the clothesline. Enraged, my mother shook her fists at me and yelled, "May all your children have ingrown toenails!" Observing that that didn't shake me, she added as a bonus, "And may your tears be so salty you spit brine for a week!" I'm not saying I fully comprehended all this, but from her tone, I sensed she wasn't wishing me a happy birthday. I noticed Grandma talked this way, too. Sometimes, when Mother had had a bad day, Grandma would smile, rather pleased with herself, and say, "I told you, Missy, if you made your bed of thorns, you'd have to walk through it in your bare feet." Or, when she really wanted to sink Mother, she'd say, "Didn't I predict that lip of yours would grow so long you'd have to take a tuck in it?" Throughout childhood, the words of wisdom continued to flow until I felt like I was living with a couple of hollow-eyed gypsies. Words of encouragement like, "May you have a wart on your nose on your wedding day and heartburn on your honeymoon," or, "Take care, Missy," little girls who sass their mothers, live to see their best friends chalk dirty words on their tombstones. None of this made much sense until I had children of my own. Now, casting curses on my children is a way of life. It's the most comforting way I know to get rid of all my anxieties, hostilities, and frustrations. And the beauty is that the kids don't comprehend a word I'm saying. I have one that's a real teaser. I just drop my shoulders, let my arms fall limp to my sides, and nod my head tiredly. I don't say anything at first, until I'm sure I have their attention. Then I say, "Wait, just wait until you're a mother." Occasionally, my son, who is very bright for 11, will remind me he's a boy and only the female species bear their young, but he gets the message. I know he does. Casting curses isn't the easiest thing in the world. To work up to a pitch, you need incentive. Like the other day when I found a pair of dirty socks stuffed in the erector set box. I yelled at the top of my voice, "I hope you have identical twins, 2 weeks apart. May your patio face southwest. May your father belch loudly at the father-son banquet." When they get home from school, I'll think of some more. Irma explains one of the joys of contemporary motherhood in Costume for the School Play, written May 29, 1968. There is nothing that does more for my mornings than to have a child announce hysterically, "Mom, I'm going to play today. I need a costume." Some mothers are lucky. They have children who get all the good parts. Their little girls are fairy princesses with magic wands and Sunday dresses, or their little boys are assigned roles as toy soldiers who can be outfitted from the toy box. Not my kids. They are always cast as a bad tooth, the 16th Amendment, or Mr. Courtesy. With a bad tooth, we faked it. I wrapped the kid in a white sheet and stuck a raisin in his navel to depict a cavity. The 16th Amendment was a bit more complicated. It deals, of course, with the power of Congress to lay and collect taxes on incomes. We outfitted her in a baggy suit with the pockets inside out and a blank check across her mouth stamped insufficient funds. Mr. Courtesy was a real challenge. We finally put him in a Superman suit, changed the big S to a big C, and told him to smile until his face broke. Last week, one of the kids did it again. "Hey, Mom, I forgot to tell you, but I'm in a play today." "Don't sweat it," I said calmly. "I'll get a costume. What are you?" "I'm a participle," he said. I steadied myself against the stove. "Split or dangling?" "You're confused," he said. "I only dangle. Dan Freebie is the one who splits. He's an infinitive." "Wonderful," I said. "Now, what did you have in mind?" "I don't care. The teachers just want me to modify Mike Ferret." "What's he wearing?" "I don't know. Whatever nouns wear." "You're right," I said. "When you see one noun, you've seen them all. Look, why don't you just wear a clean shirt and your slipover with your Sunday pants?" "That's dumb," he said. "Who'd know I was a participle?" "Who'd know you weren't?" I snapped. "If this will help you," he said, "I look exactly like a gerund." And now, A Mother's Eye, written August 18th, 1968. Of all the means of communication known to man, none is quite as effective as the mother's eye. Or as we say, one glance is worth 1,000 punches in the mouth. There are a variety, depending upon the situation, but these are a few of the old standards. The look of death. This is used on a child with a busy finger up his nose. It is similar to the frozen stare usually employed to catch a waiter's eye, but is somewhat different. It's a steady gaze, unflinching and unyielding. The brow is furrowed. The lips are firm with no trace of a smile. The face remains in a hypnotic state until the finger is removed from the nose. The deadpan glare. This is the one most often used at the dinner table for children who fill their glasses to overflowing, eat gravy with their fingers, and bulge their cheeks with food. On some occasions, the deadpan glare is accompanied by a good swift kick in the thigh under the table. The martyr's countenance. This is unmistakably the look of pain and is conjured up when a child parades down the church aisle carrying his training pants or demands the $2 you borrowed from him in the middle of a cocktail party. Some people confuse the martyr's countenance with the deadpan glare. When in doubt, remember that the martyr's countenance is accompanied by tears, biting of the lower lip until it bleeds, and fainting. The desperate squint is a real study in pantomime. The jaw is set firm, the lips curl, and the eyes are narrow and menacing. They dart back and forth. It is used when a child is loose at the mouth and asks in a loud voice if it is true Aunt Helen wouldn't know what to do with a man if she found one. If Aunt Helen happens to be in the room at the time these words are uttered, a mother often goes into her divine guidance stare. The divine guidance stare is a desperate look where her head is tilted upward, her eyes roll back until the whites show, and the lips utter what seems to be a Buddhist prayer. Perhaps the most feared of all looks is a mother's no-look look. This appears to be a blank expression to a child who is jumping on the sofa with his muddy feet or running around at a grown-up's party at 2 a.m., but beware. The most literal translation of the no-look look comes from a youngster who interpreted it as, when the company goes, head for the bed and look small and helpless until it blows over. Now we have some mother-to-mother insights in No More Oatmeal Kisses from January 1969. A young mother writes, "I know you've written about the empty nest syndrome, that lonely period after the children are grown and gone. Right now, I'm up to my eyeballs in laundry and muddy boots. The baby is teething. The boys are fighting. My husband just called and said to eat without him, and I fell off my diet. Lay it on me again, will you?" Okay. One of these days you'll shout, "Why don't you kids grow up and act your age?" And they will. Or, "You guys get outside and find yourselves something to do. And don't slam the door." And they won't. You'll straighten up the boys' bedroom neat and tidy, bumper stickers discarded, bedspread tucked and smooth, toys displayed on the shelves, hangers in the closet, animals caged. And you'll say out loud, "Now I want it to stay this way." And it will. You'll prepare a perfect dinner with a salad that hasn't been picked to death and a cake with no finger traces in the icing. And you'll say, "Now, there's a meal for company." And you'll eat it alone. You'll say, "I want complete privacy on the phone. No dancing around. No demolition crew. Silence. Do you hear me?" And you'll have it. No more plastic tablecloths stained with spaghetti. No more bedspreads to protect the sofa from damp bottoms. No more gates to stumble over at the top of the basement steps. No more clothespins under the sofa. No more playpins to arrange a room around. No more anxious nights under a vaporizer tent. No more sand on the sheets. No more iron-on patches, rubber bands for ponytails, tight boots or wet knotted shoestrings. Imagine. A lipstick with a point on it. No babysitter for New Year's Eve. Washing only once a week. Seeing a steak that isn't ground. Having your teeth cleaned without a baby on your lap. No PTA meetings. No carpools. No blaring radios. No one washing her hair at 11 o'clock at night. Having your own roll of scotch tape. Think about it. No more Christmas presents out of toothpicks and library paste. No more sloppy oatmeal kisses. No more tooth fairy. No giggles in the dark. No knees to heal. No responsibility. Only a voice crying, "Why don't you grow up?" And the silence echoing, "I did." There is some family humor in "Youngest Child Tries to Tell a Joke," written May 23, 1969. Our youngest child has been trying to tell a joke at the dinner table for the last 3 years. The same one. I feel sorry for the kid. To be on the tail end of a family means anything you come up with has either been told or isn't worth telling. We can always tell when his favorite magazine comes in the mail. He will rush into the kitchen and say, Why did it take three Boy Scouts to help a little old lady across the street? And one of the older ones will shout, "Because she didn't want to go, you cluck." Personally, I wish he'd take the magazine, crumple it, and stuff it in every opening in his face, but he never does. He always looks amazed that someone knows the answer and says, "That's right." Next month, it's the same old deal. "How do you stop an elephant from charging?" His sister, looking bored, will snap, "Let me guess. You take away his credit cards." "That's right," he says, perplexed. "About 3 years ago," he said, "Have you heard the story about a man who bought a mousetrap and went to the refrigerator for cheese in?" "Which reminds me," interrupted his father, "who ate the beer cheese?" "I didn't eat it," one of the kids said. "I used it for bass bait." In the months to follow, we were to hear the preamble to the joke dozens of times, always with interruptions, never completed. Finally, one day last week, I said, "Tell me your joke about the man with the mousetrap and the cheese for bait." "Well," he said, perching himself on the stool, "he found out he didn't have any cheese for bait, so he cut a picture from a magazine of a piece of cheese. When he woke up the next morning, know what he found in his trap? A picture of a mouse." "Tell it at dinner," I urged. Under protest, the family sat rigid and listened to the story without interruption. By the time he got to his punchline, he was hysterical. His eyes were shining with excitement, and I thought he was going to explode as he built for his big finish. "And do you know what he found in this trap?" he asked. "A mouse!" No one said a word. I wonder whether any young men got started this way. Our next story is "Are We Rich?" written June 3rd, 1971. The other day, out of a clear blue sky, Brucie asked, Are we rich? I paused on my knees as I retrieved a dime from the sweeper bag, blew the dust off it, and asked, not so you can notice. Why? How can you tell? He asked. I straightened up and thought a bit. Being rich is a relative sort of thing. Here's how I can always tell. You're rich when you buy your gas at the same service station all the time, so your glasses match. You're rich when you can have 8 people to dinner and don't have to wash forks between the main course and dessert. You're rich when you buy clothes for your kids that are 2 sizes too big for the one you buy them for and 4 sizes too big for the one that comes after him. You're rich when you own a boat without oars. You can tell people have money when they record a check and don't have to subtract it right away. People have money when they sit around and joke with the cashier while she's calling in their charge to see if it's still open. You're rich when you write notes to the teacher on paper without lines. You're rich when your television set has all the knobs on it. You're rich when you can throw away a pair of pantyhose just because it has a large hole in it. You know people are loaded when they don't have to save rubber bands from the celery and store them on a doorknob. You're rich when you can have a home wedding without Haven Funeral Home stamped on the folding chairs. You're rich when the Scouts have a paper drive and you have a stack of the New York Times in your basement. You're rich when your dog is wet and smells good. You're rich when your own hair looks so great everyone thinks it's a wig. Brucie sat quietly for a moment, then said, I think my friend Ronnie is rich. How can you tell? I asked. His mom buys his birthday cake at a bakery, and it isn't even cracked on the top. He's rich, all right, I sighed. Let's finish with the bittersweet story written by Anna Quindlen, titled The Days of Gilded Rigatoni. This story is found in the book Crème de la Femme, The Best of Contemporary Women's Humor. Breakfast will be perfect. I know this from experience. Poached eggs, expertly done, the toast in triangles, the juice fresh squeezed, a pot of coffee, a rose in a bud vase, a silver tray. I will eat every bit. Breakfast will be perfect, except that it will be all wrong. The eggs should be a mess. In some no man's land between fried and scrambled, the toast underdone, the orange juice slopped over into the place where the jelly should be, if there were jelly, which there is not. Coffee lukewarm, tray steel gray, and suspiciously like a cookie sheet. I get to eat the yucky parts. I know this from experience. Today is Mother's Day, and the room service waiter at the hotel is bringing my breakfast. No handprint in a plaster of Paris circle with a ribbon through a hole in the top. Nothing made out of construction paper or macaroni spray-painted gold and glued to cardboard. This is a disaster. Any of the other 364 days of the year would be a wonderful time for a woman with small children to have a morning of peace and quiet. But solitary splendor on this day is like being a book with no reader. It raises that age-old question. If a mother screams in the forest and there are no children to hear it, is there any sound? It has become commonplace to complain that Mother's Day is a manufactured holiday cooked up by greeting card moguls and covens of florists. But these complaints usually come from grown-ups who find themselves on a one-way street, who are stymied each year by the question of what to give a mature woman who says she has everything her heart desires, except grandchildren. It has become commonplace to flog ourselves, if we are mothers, with our limitations, if we stay home with the kids, with our obligations, if we take jobs. It's why sometimes mothers who are not working outside their homes seem to suggest that the kids of those who are live on Chips Ahoy and walk barefoot through the snow to school. It's why sometimes mothers with outside jobs feel moved to ask about those other women, allegedly without malice. What do they do all day? And amid that incomplete revolution in the job description, the commercial Mother's Day seems designed to salute a mother who is an endangered species, if not an outright fraud, a mother who is pink instead of fuchsia, a mother who bakes cookies and never cheats with the microwave, a mother who does not swear or scream, who wears an apron and a patient smile, not a mother who is away from home on a business trip on Mother's Day, not a mother who said, "You can fax it to me, honey," when her son said he had written something in school, and who is now doomed to remember that sentence the rest of her miserable life. Not an imperfect mother. The Mother's Day that means something, the Mother's Day that is not a duty but a real holiday, is about the perfect mother. It is about the mother before she becomes the human being, when she is still the center of our universe, when we are very young. They are not long, the days of construction paper and gilded rigatoni. That's why we save those things so relentlessly. Why the sisterhood of motherhood, those of us who can instantly make friends with a stranger by discussing colic and orthodonture, have as our coat of arms a sheet of small handprints executed in finger paint. Each day, we move a little closer to the sidelines of their lives, which is where we belong if we do our job right, until the day comes when they have to find a florist fast at noon because they had totally forgotten it was anything more than the second Sunday in May. Hassle City. The little ones do not forget. They cut and paste and sweat over palsied capital letters and things built of popsicle sticks about which you much never say, "What is this?" Just for a little while, they believe in the perfect mom. That is, you. Whoever and wherever you happen to be, "Everything I am," they might say, "I owe to my mother." And they believe they wrote the sentence themselves, even if they have to give you the card a couple of days late. Over the phone, you can say, "They don't make breakfast the way you make it," and they will believe it, and it will be true. Now I have a few quotes about motherhood from the book Mother, A Book of Quotations, edited by Herb Gailwitz. "There never was a child so lovely, but his mother was glad to get him to sleep." And that was written by Ralph Waldo Emerson. "Every boy who has a dog should also have a mother, so the dog will be fed regularly." That was found in the Globe, North Dakota newspaper. "Love is a roller coaster. Motherhood is the whole amusement park." Kathy Geiswhite. And from Phyllis Diller, "Cleaning your house while your kids are still growing up is like shoveling the walk before it stops snowing." And finally, "A mother becomes a true grandmother the day she stops noticing the terrible things her children do because she is so enchanted with the wonderful things her grandchildren do." Lois Wise. That's all we have time for today. Join me next month for That's a Laugh. I'm Sharon Silcox with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website at trianglereadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. 3251-38.